Other things after July. All welcome, DG and your team. You're all welcome. Members of the portfolio committee, this meeting cannot go without you, so you don't need anyone to welcome you. On the program today, we're briefing on the strategic and annual performance plan of the Department of Labor and entities. Today, DG, we're coming to listen to what are on your plans, what you're going to do in the next year, and then at the same time, the step by step in terms of how you're going to implement those strategies that we'll be presenting. So, without much ado, let me give over to you, DG, and to take us through this. Dinner will be served around 6:30, and then we'll push until 8 o'clock. And transport is available for members to drop to take you to your compounds. Emma Hostel, thank you very much. Kwando Gwenz, DG. Is it three or four apologies? We have four apologies. The first one here, Adrian Williams, honorable, is not in very good health. There's Mango, who is stuck in Durban. You'll be in Cape Town tomorrow, Honorable Mango. And Lion Hendricks, she said there's a clash with the other meeting in another committee, so she decided to go and attend that one and not this one. We have an apology. Who is the other one? And Honorable, what's his name? Do we have Albert? Oh yeah, we have a standing apology, Honorable Albert. So, and then Honorable van der Vesde has a pre-arranged meeting that he cannot get away from. Those are the apologies. Honorable Manamana, comrade sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. The apology of Honorable Albert, when is it sitting down? It has been steady for a while. But the apology of Honorable Line, the portfolio committee, which is public administration, is having their EPC
Let's give them a chance. We'll give you another
3 minutes. They're having their EPC on Thursday, so they have a study group meeting today to finalize preparations for that EPC, so that's why she chose to go to that study group. Thank you.
No. We were denied that data, that is very understandable. DG, we all don't need introduction here, unless if we have a new person who needs to know who we are in your team. Our team hasn't changed. Thank you.
No, ours too. I'm trying to check anything is possible. it hasn't changed. It hasn't changed, Chairperson. Thanks very much. It's still the same set of people. And thanks for this invitation, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. The presentation that we want to run before you is essentially where we want to start off, is essentially a reflection on the amount of progress that we have made in the particularly up to quarter three, which is the end of December 2012, but also we will take stock and share with you some of the areas where we have not been able to progress in the manner that we had set ourselves to, and therefore reflect on the question of the variance insofar as the areas of non-achievement and so forth. We'll also look at the question of a summary of expenditure patterns against the deliverables and strategic objectives of the department. And of course, the last two areas, the first one before last is the question of the strat plan itself and so on, as well as the annual performance plans for 2013-2014. Lastly is our, what is it that we expect from this committee? You know, there are specific issues on which we would want to lobby the portfolio committee and so forth. And in this regard, Chair, without further ado, I would ask that we follow the branch outline in the presentation and ask that Corporate Services, which is responsible for administration, takes us through that. Essentially what it means, Chair, is that with your permission, from slide 2 to slide 7, we'll ask that we skip those because that's your general legislative and constitutional mandate issues and so on, so would ask that we don't necessarily go through those, and therefore the actual presentation will start from page 8 onwards.
Thank you, Chair. Good evening. Honourable members, I will take you through quarter 1, 2, 3 and 4 reports for corporate services. I will focus on the achievements or progress made thus far. And the administration, program 1 is the program on administration, for which I'm responsible for, and that covers HRM, security, ICT, the Office of the Director General, the Office of the Minister, risk management, internal audit, and it also covers finance. And we look at running an efficient, effective, and development-oriented public service and an empowered and inclusive citizenship, which is part of Outcome 12. And this is Strategic Objective 8, which speaks to strengthening the institutional capacity of the department. And I will go to the key performance indicators, what our annual targets are in respect of that, and progress thus far. And key performance indicator number 1 is strategic risks monitored in line with our risk appetite framework. The target is that we should provide a quarterly strategic risk monitoring report to the accounting officer. And progress made thus far is that the strategic risk assessment, or our risk profile, the risk profile of the Department of Labor, was reviewed and reports were prepared. And these reports have been approved by the National Risk Management Committee and the Audit Committee. And these have been submitted to the accounting officer for approval. The risk appetite framework has also been finalized, and the first report was provided to the accounting officer. The second key performance indicator speaks to the percentage of finalization of the fraud cases received and detected within the department. We've given ourselves an annual target of 87% of cases to be received or detected and finalized by the end of the financial year. Thus far, we have 57% of the cases that have already been finalized. We've received 7 cases and 4 have been finalized. Chairperson, I'm not sure if you would want me to go through where these have been specifically, There's a table there that speaks to those. At head office, we've received one, finalized it, so there's nothing outstanding. In Mpumalanga, we received two, there's one outstanding. In the Northern Cape, we have received none. In Limpopo, none. In the Northwest, none. In the Eastern Cape, none. In Gauteng, we received three. We have one outstanding. In the Free State, we received one, and it's still outstanding. In KZN, none. In the Western Cape, none. Our key performance indicator number three is for pre-employment screening. Our target is that 70% pre-employment screening should be finalized as per our annual plan. And progress thus far says that we have a total of 80.92% of requests which have been finalized, of the pre-screening requests which have been finalized. And that table basically gives you what is outstanding. At head office, we received 24. There's nothing outstanding. At the UIF, we received 6. There's only one outstanding. At the Compensation Commission, we received 6. There's none outstanding. In Mpumalanga, we received 10. There is 7 outstanding. In Limpopo, 13. There's none outstanding. In the Northwest, we received 7. There's one outstanding. Eastern Cape, 11. 7 outstanding. Gauteng, 23. And we have 3 outstanding. And in the Free State, there were 9 requests received, and we have 2 outstanding. In KwaZulu-Natal, we have received six, and there's 2 outstanding. The Western Cape, there's 12, and there's 2 outstanding. So in total, we received 131 requests for pre-employment screening, and we have finalized 106. Our fourth key performance indicator is the percentage of SMS members vetted within the department. The number should be increased. Our target is a target of 80%, and progress thus far says that we have 23 requests outstanding. So we have 11 forms which have been forwarded, 5 clearance certificates have been received, and 23 are outstanding. On key performance indicator number 5, it says that we have to have a percentage of women, youth, and people with disability employed in line with our employment equity plan. Chairperson and honorable members, our annual target is that of 40% of women should be employed in SMS, 43% youth, and 3% of people with disabilities should be employed by the Department of Labor by the 31st of March 2013. As things stand today, we have 39% of women employed at SMS level, we have 35% of youth employed, and 2.7% of people with disabilities. We are targeting that by the 31st of March 2014, we should have 40% women at SMS level, but this is 45% rather, sorry, not 40, 45% of women by the 31st of March. We think that we shall have reached that target actually before January of 2014. And on people with disabilities, we have a target of 3%, where the target for the public service is actually sitting at 2%. The minimum is 2%. We think we can go beyond the minimum that is required, hence the 3% target. Our sixth key performance indicator is that we need to have filled all our vacancies within a specified period of time. Our annual target is that the vacancy rate needs to be reduced to below 7% by the 31st of March 2013. As things stand, we are sitting at a 7% vacancy rate as at the end of quarter two. Now, we already have a strategy on how we should reduce this. We are abolishing unfunded vacancies within the department because those are problematic by their very nature. And we're monitoring our vacancy rates every week and reporting on progress on a weekly basis to also put pressure, especially at at provinces and within the two funds, the UIF and the compensation fund. We, on key performance indicator number 7, that performance indicator says that we have to have a percentage of staff trained in line with workplace skills plan, and the annual target is 82% of the department staff should be trained in accordance with approved workplace skills plan by the 31st of March 2013. Progress here as at quarter 2 says that we have 35% of people trained. Now, when you look at the 35% against the background of an annual target of 82%, it might be a bit misleading because training by its very nature is not short-termish. We have, for example, a program in the department where people are being trained over a year, in some instances over 18 months. So we are, when we say 35%, we mean people who have already completed that training. Key performance indicator number 8 is the percentage of misconduct cases that need to be finalized within a prescribed period of time. We've given ourselves an annual target of 75% of cases to be finalized in line with applicable prescripts. And to date, we have 71% cases that have been finalized. So we have finalized 92 out of 130 cases. Key performance indicator number 9 speaks to the implementation of the new ICT strategy. The annual target says that we have to have 50% of our strategic plan components implemented. Progress thus far is that our ICT strategy has been developed and it has been approved, and in fact 50% of the ICT transition in line with the strategy has already been completed. Key performance indicator number 10 says that exit and services transfer plan has got to be developed and implemented. This is in the ICT space, in the IT space. The annual target is that we have to have completed a handover of the PPP contract and closeout of the PPP. Progress is that the end services transfer milestones have been achieved and the project is underway. The target is, of course, the end of November 2012. And that brings us to the end of Program 1, which is administration. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. If I ask Mr. Sefin to come in and supervise inspection and enforcement services at this point in time.
The floor is yours, teacher.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, honorable members. Good evening. the first indicator, and before I go to the key indicator, just probably locate IAS within the context of the delivery outcomes of government, and it's located to the decent employment through inclusive economic growth outcome, and the strategic objective deals with the promotion of equity in the labour market. Our key indicator was that we had wanted to do a percentage of employers complying with the EA plan to reflect demographics. This was differentiated between public and private companies. we expected to inspect 100 public companies and 200 private companies, and out of that 300 wanted to do, 80% of them should have been compliant. Now, if you look at the Employment Equity Commission report on employment equity, the outcomes that has been achieved fundamentally reflects the reality that the report has suggested. Out of the 340 companies, we've done 181, and some of these investigations are still underway because it spans across a number of periods, and some started at the end of the financial year, and therefore it carries over into the new year. You will see in the table below the sort of target that we've set at the provincial level, both in terms of public and private companies. And the achievements against these private, and I'll tease out of the table just one or two of the examples. KZN had an annual target of 17. They've completed one. The reality of the matter is that the one, when you start investigating the one, you will find different entities in the company. So you have to inspect all of those different entities in terms of employment. So instead of the one, for example, in KZN, there were about 13 entities that is linked to that company that needed to be inspected, as an example. Northwest, just further down the table, in terms of public companies, were required to do 10, and they've completed 12. In private companies, they were required to do 6, and they completed the 6 out of the requirement in relationship to that. The second key performance indicator was that we had to inspect 80% of workplaces inspected in the problematic sectors. Now, the problematic sectors have been defined problematic in relationship to the number of complaints received, and we've identified 3 or 4 of these problematic sectors, and strategically we have lifted them out of the economy so that we focus our attention on this. One of them is wholesale and retail, the other is the forestry, and the third one is the hospitality sector. We also have the private security sector in terms of the problematic sectors. Can I just pause a minute with the percentage of compliance? Fundamentally, the requirement to comply is not the Department of Labor's requirement. It is a requirement of the inspector of the company to comply with the law. And our intent was that out of that non-compliance or the inspections, we wanted to ensure that 80% of those companies that we inspected were compliant. Now, for out of the target of 32,838, we've completed 33,917, but this was at the end of September 2012. We have, in total, for the financial year, just as a matter of interest, conducted almost 135,000 for the inspections for the full year. And we found a level of compliance of 59%. This fundamentally then says, what do you do with the 41% that is non-compliant? And that is the focus going forward. Instead of focusing on the companies that are complying, you need to focus on the companies that are non-compliant rather than those that are complying. I'll tease out also from the table in terms of the hospitality sector, Chair, a number of data and statistics in terms of our inspections. In the Free State, for example, we have we set a target for 412. They have conducted 293 inspections. Out of the 293, 252 companies were compliant for percentage level at 86%. A telling achievement here is the Western Cape, where we've done 46. We set a target of 462 investigations. We've completed 940, and out of that 940, 277 companies have complied, to get a total of 20, sort of a compliance level of 29%. You will see this trend reflective right through the presentation in terms of the compliance levels with the Western Cape going forward. I'll just tease out of the agricultural sector. Also some of these some of these examples. Eastern Cape, we set a target of 1,094. They've conducted 959. 696% of those 959 companies were compliant at a compliance level of 73%. Just further down the table, Western Cape again. They were set a target at 441. They've completed 964. 247 of that 964 companies were non-compliant in the agricultural, were compliant with a compliance level of 26%, and you will see the trend as I've indicated in the tables. Also in the iron and steel industry, the same applies here, Chief. Gauteng was set a target of 1,517. They've completed 159. 80 of those companies were compliant with the compliance level of 50. Further down the table, the same sort of information, same sort of trend reflects for the Western Cape. Mm. And you go and you will go through the table as delineated. Private security sector is an example, which is one of the sectors with the most number of complaints emanates from. 130 was set as a target in the Eastern Cape. They've done 791 out of the 791. 506 were compliant at a compliance level of 64%. Northern Cape, and I've just deliberately skipped to Western Cape again, they set a target of 32. They've done 139 and a compliance level of 88% in that table. Now, whilst these targets are set at the different levels, you would notice that some provinces go beyond the target that has been set. Obviously, you can't turn a complainant away, and you need to deal with those issues irrespective of the target that you've set. Domestic workers, Chair, for the Eastern Cape, they, for example, set a target of 327. They've conducted 491 inspections. 330 of those employees were compliant at the compliance level at 67%. And perhaps for the sake of some benefit, Free State was set a target of 284. They've conducted 460 inspections. Out of that 460 inspections, 440 were compliant with a compliance level of 96%. Scale down the table, Western Cape compliance level of 15% out of the target that was set. And the trend continues in relationship to chemical sector. As an example, Gauteng had a target of 720. They've done 119. 60 of those 119 companies were compliant at a compliance level of 50. In construction, now can I just step back a bit? The chemical sector, the construction sector, the iron and steel sector are fundamentally what we call higher risk sectors. And if you look at the sort of compliance levels in these sectors, and you compare it with the sort of claims that comes from the compensation fund, you will see a strong corollary out of that relationship, where the majority of the claims from the compensation fund, where they're dealing with claims, come from these sectors that have been identified as strategic sectors for a focus in terms of. So if you look at the claims history of the compensation fund and you look at the sort of compliance level of these sectors, construction, iron and steel, chemical, electrical, you will see sort of the same sort of pattern emerging out of this. The construction sector, for example, where we've just signed, for example, for this year, an accord that seeks to have companies comply voluntarily. In the Eastern Cape, they set a target of 205. They couldn't do any of those inspections. KZN set a target of 1,057. They have a number of compliant companies as 50, and out of the number that they've conducted, you have an 80% level of compliance. Key performance indicators that before a case goes to an inspector, they need to be resolved as quickly as possible, as urgently as possible, so that at least we deal with the complainant in a sort of more dignified manner and achieve the dictates of service delivery. And therefore, one of the things that we've set as a target was that the complaints that we receive at the provincial level, at the labour centre, should 70% of those complaints should be dealt with within 14 days. For the period under review, we've received 54,484 complaints, and 65% was dealt with in a period of 14 days, which set a settlement rate of about 70% in that area. Obviously, some of these complaints take longer than just the 14 days that emerge. Can I just tease out for the sake of totality, out of the table below, some of the examples that we have? Eastern Cape again received 4,081 complaints. They've settled 2,381 at a settlement rate of 58%. Northwest received 2,684 complaints. They've settled 1,464, and the average level of compliance is 55%, of settlement rather, is 55%. One of the key strategic areas that we wanted to address was the issue around exposure to silica dust, and we've set a target for the Western Cape and KZN, and this will be rotated among the provinces because of the sort of specialized nature of measuring silica dust exposure. The 200 workplaces that we'd wanted to inspect it, we've only managed to do 63. And all of these companies were done in the Western Cape. The second key indicator that we'd wanted to do was to have a sort of a baseline in terms of noise-induced hearing loss and in the iron and steel industry. And in order to develop that baseline, we wanted to have done a report, a baseline study on the noise-induced hearing loss. The report, as submitted to you, says that the research is in progress. I want to report that the research has been completed, and we will then the lessons learned from the research will be rolled out to the different provinces. One of the areas that we also want to address is the amendment of the Occupational Health and Safety Act. Advisory Council on Occupational Health and Safety has done its work on the Occupational Health and Safety Act, and currently the Amendment Act is with the state law advisors, and we will try and post haste submit that to Parliament for its processes. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. Public employment services contribute towards outcome 4, which is about improving the quality and accessibility of labour market services to contribute to decent employment through inclusive economic growth. And the contribution to decent employment creation, apart from public employment services, is also shared with a number of public entities associated with the Department of Labor. Now, under the strategy, that is the key performance indicator, employment legislation, regulation, and guidelines in place, as at the end of December, which is quarter 3, the bill was already in Parliament and draft regulations were developed, and currently we are waiting for the finalization of the bill so that we can then have the Employment Services Board established to can then finalize the draft regulations that are in place so that we don't spend a lot of time once the bill becomes law. On the second indicator, increased number of work seekers registered in different categories. As at the end of December, 450,000 was our target, and already third quarter we were at 427 with 3 months to go, which was a remarkable achievement, and this could be attributed to the number of job fairs we had throughout the country. And you have a percentage breakdown or contribution by individual provinces. On the percentage of work seekers registered on the systems provided with career counseling and employability enhancement, we put a target of 60%, which was to be the total number of people that we put through the process. As at the end of December, already 207,000 of work seekers were already profiled, and in some cases provided with a number of career counseling processes. Those of you attended the job fairs or read about the job fairs in the newspapers, you would have noticed that we have embarked on a number of innovative ways of providing counseling so that you can deal with a large number of people given the less number of career counselors we have. And what you then have is a breakdown per province, with Gauteng a target of 108, and by then you can see the breakdown in terms of the target profiled vis-a-vis the actual number of people profiled. The next one talks to the number of work seekers placed or referred to opportunities. Now, there, honorable members, against a target of 18,000 as at the end of December, already 10,400 were confirmed placed work seekers, and against a target of 72,000 we had referred 278,000. Now, this was largely because of the number of employers that were using the system. And one of the problems that we continue to experience and why the process of getting confirmation from the referrals that we have is that currently one of the instruments that we are supposed to have in force, which is the regulation compelling either work seekers and employers to give us feedback, is not yet in existence, and we rely on follow-up telephonic calls and people referred giving us feedback, which is why we have recorded a small number. And going forward, we are thinking of linking this process with CIA so that the minute people who are referred are employed and are registered on the either income tax or as unemployment insurance fund beneficiaries, we can quickly pick them off the system and remove them off the database of registered work seekers. The next one talks to the number of employers registering vacancies on ESA per annum increased from 2,000 to 3,000. And against a target of 1,000, we've seen a lot of companies coming on board, as at the end of December, already 1,924 companies were beginning to utilize the system and registering vacancies, because they've since noticed or became aware of the benefits associated with utilizing the system. And you have a breakdown per province in terms of registration of companies. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
Okay.
Thank you, DG, and thank you, Honorable members. Labor policy and industrial relations. Our program, this program, we're dealing with decent employment through inclusive economic growth. Just to make one correction, honorable members, the first indicator should raise employment equity, not the BCA, the Basic Condition of Employment Act. Here we had a target of finalizing the processes at NEDLAC by November 2012, and this was met. We finalized the process by July, and the bill was approved by Cabinet and submitted to Parliament, as is in Parliament currently. The next area that we indicated we had was to make sure that the Code of Good Practice and Technical Assistance Guidelines on HIV and AIDS are reviewed and amended. The annual target on this was that the code and the technical assistance must be amended by June 2012. And this amendment is to make sure that these codes and these technical guidelines are in line with the newly adopted recommendation by the International Labour Organization. We had to amend our codes and our technical guidelines to meet those recommendations that were approved by the ILO. And that was done by June 2012, and 14 awareness workshops were conducted in all the provinces on both the HIV code and the tag. The next area was income differential, assessing of companies to determine race and gender on income. This is purely on income. And we set aside 30 companies that needed to be assessed on income differential, and 30 companies were assessed, and the recommendation signed by the DG and submitted in the companies to implement incorporating affirmative action measures to address those income differentials that we've picked up in all of those 30 companies that we've assessed. The next area that we deal with is protection of vulnerable workers. This is an area dealing with review existing sectoral determination. We target to publish an amended sector determination minimum wages for one sector by June 2000, and we amended the listed sectors, hospitality, private security, taxi, civil engineering, and we are currently dealing with information and research on the taxi sector. The taxi sector is not amended yet. We're busy with the research on that, but the rest have been finalized. The last area that we dealt with is the areas of also protecting vulnerable workers. We had an indicator to investigate new areas for setting sector determination. We set a target of investigating two new sectors. Two sectors were investigated, the possibility of a medical aid for security sector, and this has been finalized and submitted to the ECC for deliberation. I must just indicate to the members that in the deliberation in the ECC, both parties, employers and employees in this, were not comfortable in having a medical aid in the sector because of the cost involved for specifically for workers having to bear 50% of the cost of that because of the level of wages. But in terms of our target, we've met it, but the result of that investigation is that our clients, our stakeholders, are really not ready for it. Therefore, we shelve it a little bit until we deal with the issues of vulnerability within the sector. The last area that we had to deal with was also dealing with funding of civil society organizations through the Civil Society Fund. In this process, we funded so far the four federations, DITSELA, and we're busy funding other smaller advice offices. The next area is the extension of collective agreement within 60 days. This is where we've extended 9 bargaining council agreements to non-parties. And as members would know, this is a very contested area, the extension of collective agreement. We've got on the go more about, I think, 4 cases challenging the right of the minister to extend this collective agreement. This is a very, very contested area. 3 of those cases, members, are by particular employer organization in the metal industry, in the motor industry, two in the metal industry. I mean, the big one is by the one that challenged the constitutionality of the section that allowed the minister to extend by our friends, Market Foundation, who are challenging that area. And we think all of those cases that are challenging these areas are going to end up in the Constitutional Court. We hope we'll win, we're confident of our case, but as you know, members, you can never be sure in terms of these legal issues, especially in the Constitutional Court. But if the minister loses the right to extend collective agreement, then that will be the end of collective bargaining, because the essence of collective bargaining is being able to extend those agreements to all parties also. If you are not able to do that, collective bargaining is not going to succeed in the country. We hope the Constitutional Court will see it as we see it. The next area, which is also very contested, is the area of registration of organization. In this area, we've set aside to register organization and deregister them, those that are bogus, within 90 days. We've received 29 applications in this area. We've approved 5 and we've refused 24. As you can see, members, that the rate of refusal is very high in this area. Precisely, we're very concerned about the proliferation of trade unions within different sectors, and we think this is another area where proliferation of trade union play into violence and strife because of the competition between the parties that are in the area, and we are very strict in who we register for them to come in because of the effect it has on the economy. The annual turnaround time on this is around about 83 days. That's the area.
Sorry, can I ask you, Mr. Morodova, to take us through the variations that we have had insofar as meeting some of the stated objectives on our side, basically just to hone into the areas as to why in certain areas we've had such variances and so on. Yeah, I'm asking him to do so as in his acting capacity as the Chief Operations Officer. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, DG. Again, Honorable Chairperson and members. Broadly under contribution to employment creation, on work seekers, the key challenge has to do with the skills levels of people we refer, but those that we refer, we are confident that we have taken them through assessment process, and the main issue has to do with the feedback process from employers, and at the same time to look at employment schemes as agreed at NEDLAC for those people that cannot go back to the schooling system. On the registration of private employment agencies, currently the big issue is the legal enforcement, because there's no consequences for not registering, and I'm sure honorable members may have read about a number of agencies that make false promises, advertise, and get people to pay monies with the promise of employment, and at the end of the day disappear in thin air, and nothing is done against those companies because our current enforcement mechanisms are not up to scratch. And that's why in the Employment Services Bill, we want to regulate that area. On the learners with disability recruited, this was mainly linked to the expansion or self-receiving contract, and at the same time beginning to go beyond the manufacturing but to do training. We've had numerous discussions with the Department of Higher Education and Training, and the feeling is that SEF and from the business case that was conducted is that if SEF is to venture into that area, it will take a lot of time, maybe 5 to 10 years, and that the education or the skills development component should be left to higher Department of Education. Hence, they need to review the program. On the number of jobs saved, there was a hitch in the question of the approval of funding allocation to Productivity SA, but this has since been corrected. It's just that the program started very late, and as a result, the number of jobs saved in various companies is was low at the end of December. on the promotion of equity, the NEDLAC issue has been resolved. The bill is now in Parliament, and we are hoping that the finalization thereof will assist us to enforce a number of components. On protecting vulnerable workers, in the main, the areas, the problematic sectors such as agriculture and forestry and current developments within the farming sector, and the capacity and resources constraints within KZN were some of the issues that contributed towards some of the targets not being achieved, and hence the need to revitalize the sectoral discussions. And the BCA amendment, I think Mr. Mkaripi touched on that issue. On the strengthening of social protection, with regard to the number of workplace audited to determine compliance levels with regard to OHS, the areas, reasons for major variances range from workplaces audited to determine their OHS compliance levels, especially in agricultural and forestry, being low, and this is linked to the whole question of the developments within the farming sectors and the insufficient capacity within, especially in the KZN, as highlighted by Mr. Vigil. And the corrective action that we agreed to during the midterm assessment, so as to improve compliance level during the remaining period, that is January to March, was to embark on training programs so that we can build the capacity of the inspectorate, and that by end of April we have improved the situation. On promoting sound labor relations, I think Mr. Mkalipi talked about some of the challenges that we have, but we believe that the finalization of the Labor Relations Act amendment will help in terms of the process. And he did talk about other research pieces that have been embarked upon to determine things like split in unions and incidences such as Marikana, etc. On strengthening the institutional capacity of the department, we, amongst the key areas, was to revise the DOR strategic plan and make sure that we are able to comply with the prescript in terms of tabling the strat plan 2013-14 to 2018 and annual performance plan 13-14. Now, the first slide that the DG indicated we should skip gives the context, honourable members, on what happened and what led to us publishing an erratum that supplemented the strat plan that we tabled. It was not a withdrawal, it was a supplementing, and it did indicate areas where we made adjustments. We tabled that in February, but that work assisted us to also finalize the strat plan and annual performance plan 13-14, and we met the deadline of 13 March 2013, which was given by Parliament and for all departments to meet. So that process was also finalized, and we have now embarked on a process to make sure that during the bid time and the planning process for year 14-15, we don't have problems that we experienced previously. And I'll ask Mr. Maduna to talk on the expenditure and the allocations.
Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, the presentation for finance is going to cover two parts. One, to look at the expenditure for the period under review, and then secondly, to look at the allocations that have been made to the department for the year 2013-14 to 2015-16. In terms of the finances for the period under review, the department has defrayed expenditure to the value of 1.7 billion against the adjusted budget of 2.1 billion. This represents the expenditure of a level of 82.8% against the time of 83%, which indicates that I think for this period we're still proceeding nicely in terms of our expending. Looking at the same amount for each program, administration had spent 82%. I spent 73% of their budget, whilst inspection and enforcement services, it was 82%. Public employment services, it was 86%. The LP and IR, they have spent 94% of their budget for the period under review. It probably might appear as an anomaly. Fortunately, it's by design. Quite a number of our entities are residing in that program, and we have signed some SLAs for the advanced transfers of their budgets. So, as at the way, we have already transferred some of their allocations for the fourth quarter. Hence, in terms of the program, it appears as if they have probably almost finish their budget. It's because of the transfers that we have made to public entities for them to continue spending their budget. In terms of the graph there, it indicates the same amount, well, the same information in a graphical format, and also the next slide also presented the same information, but in terms of the economic classification, which I'm just not gonna deal with it now. In terms of our MTF allocation, the department for the 2013-14 financial year, we've been given a budget of 2.4 billion, and for the 14-15, a budget of 2.6 billion as an indicative amount, and also for the 15-16, the budget of 2.7 billion. We've also allocated the same amount in terms of the economic classification for noting. In terms of the MTF allocations, there has been a reduction over the MTF period of 18.5 million in our budget, which has been affected on program one. On administration from goods and services, travel and subsistence, 9.7 million, communication, 4 million, and machinery and equipment, 4.8 million, and 520,000 for program 4 in terms of the transfers transferred to strengthen civil society due to efficiency savings that have been forced on us by the National Treasury. And the department has received an additional allocation of 95 million over the MTF period for the adjustments to improvements of in conditions of service. That then concludes the finances of the department in as far as the strat plan is concerned.
Thank you again, Honorable Chairperson. Now, just to link the current, that is the previous financial year, and the current financial year, that is the 12-13 and 13-14. We have now concluded the reporting cycle. Figures for the 3 months have now been finalized, and they are now being prepared for auditing process. And the report will change significantly, and we now have a preliminary report. But linked to that, We are required in terms of the prescript to also plan ahead, and already we are in the second month of the new financial year. And as part of the framework set up by the presidency, we had to do an assessment of the challenges that we still continue to face despite all our efforts and interventions that we have. And for the department, we highlighted five key challenges. And these challenges, those who are familiar with the NDP, are some of the challenges that are well captured within the National Development Plan. And amongst the key challenges that the department continues to face is addressing the question of unemployment, especially amongst young people and those who have lost employment, and underemployment. And this has to do with people who may be employed, but the employment or jobs that they hold are either below their qualifications or the remuneration they get is not in line with what they would normally would get in other areas. And our interventions to address issues of unemployment range from all the entities that we fund. Almost half of our budget goes to these entities, CCMA, NEDLAC, Productivity SA, Sheltered Employment, and so on. And this is because these entities, including the Unemployment Insurance Fund and the Compensation Fund, they play a major role in extending our legislative mandate to deal with employment-related matters, and especially to either keep people in jobs, to save jobs, or to make sure that those who lose employment are provided with interim relief whilst looking for employment, and they can get back into employment as much as we can, as they can. The amendment to current legislation is part of that process, and the introduction of the new legislation, Employment Services Bill, is part of that, and establishing strategic partners for collaboration in creating and delivering value to citizens are all efforts aimed at addressing that first challenge. The second one relates to the changing nature of work. Obviously, with the advent of new technology, changing labor market needs, and so on, we've seen a lot of jobs being lost in other sectors and so on. Now, part of our interventions have to do with the Basic Conditions of Employment Act amendments and a whole range of initiatives that entities such as Productivity SA, etc., are dealing with to improve productivity and to save jobs. The third challenge relates to inequality and unfair discrimination. And I'm sure those who have had access to the Employment Equity Report, you will know or notice that we still have a long way to go in terms of addressing inequality in the various workplaces. And amendments to the Employment Equity, the publication of sectoral determination, employment services system inspection and enforcement interventions are all aimed at making sure that we protect the most vulnerable workers and we eliminate inequality in the labor market. The fourth challenge relates to domestic as well as cross-border labor migration. Honorable members will know that we are faced with economic migrants, refugees. We are also faced with migration that results from scarce skills in a number of areas. And all our interventions, including working with other departments such as Home Affairs, are aimed at making sure that whilst we ensure a smooth transition and movement of people, the rights of citizens are also not compromised in the process. And this is done through a number of interventions such as sectoral determinations for domestic workers, the extension of UIF to those sectors, and labor migration management. I've touched on that. The fifth challenge relates to inadequate instruments for constant performance monitoring and evaluation of labor market policies and programs to determine their impact on the economy. And this range from the capacity of the staff within the Department of Labor to do their work and to have adequate tools. And the interventions relates to changing the way in which we work, transforming from head office, provincial office to our labor centers, and that is why we have interventions such as Shanduka to review our workflow processes so as to realign with the changing nature of work. Secondly, to make sure that our delivery points, be it labor centers, tourism centers, mobile centers, etc., are accessible to the clients that we serve, and reconfiguring and repositioning our delivery points to improve the quality of services. And lastly, developing a service delivery model that will make sure that throughout the points that we have, we can serve people. So what we then did was to use those analysis and then to craft our new strat plan. And the strat plan has detailed targets that I'm not going to go through. And the APP for 13-14 again clearly indicates exactly how we are going to go about achieving some of the targets. And the CFO has alluded or talked to the budget allocation. So briefly, I'll just summarize per program the strategic objective and the performance indicator. Under administration, the key one has to do with the organizational strategic plan and annual performance plan. And the performance indicator talks to the strategic plan and annual performance plan approved and tabled as prescribed in terms of the time frames, which we have done on the 13th of March. On the organizational performance monitored, we have to make sure that we manage and facilitate the whole question of organizational performance. And the reason why we are able to come to you, honorable members, and say up to the end of December, this is what we have done, and the minister will be talking to what we have done up to the end of March, and the annual report that is to be tabled to you will then continue contain detailed and information that is audited to give you an independent observation on our performance by the Auditor General. And we talk about one annual report and four organizational performance report, and the performance information that we produce is going to be contained in the annual reports within 60 days at the end of each quarter. And that is why we could not come to you and give you final information until end of March, because we have to do verification and checks for all the information, and we have given ourselves 60 days to complete that process. On service delivery improvement plan, we'll submit a reviewed and approved service delivery plan to the public service and administration in accordance with the prescribed timeframes. On the annual audit plan, and we have given ourselves a performance indicator on the percentage of final reports issued as per timeframes indicated are approved and audited. So our internal audit, apart from just accepting reports, they also audit the information provided, and they've given themselves time frames. Under IES, under strategic objective, ensure promotion of employment equity in the labor market. The performance indicators range from the number of companies and private companies reviewed for compliance and the percentage of non-compliant workplaces of those inspected dealt with in terms of the enforcement regime linked to the Employment Equity Act. Continued on inspection and enforcement. Under strategic objective, reduction in worker vulnerability through improved compliance and enforcement, there are a number of performance indicators ranging from the number of workplaces inspected, percentage of non-compliance compliant workplaces inspected, and number of advocacy and educational seminars conducted in identified sectors. Public Employment Services, strategic objective, employment services legislation, related regulations and guidelines tabled. The performance indicator talks to percentage of work completed on the bill and the regulations and guidelines. And again, the APP gives you a detailed breakdown on the past initiatives and interventions communicated through various media. We have a number of indicators that talks to advocacy campaigns per province, and the performance indicator talks to those number of advocacy campaigns conducted, and the details in terms of the breakdown per province are also clearly stated in the annual performance plan. On the workplace registered on the systems, that is work seekers registered on the system, we have a target of the number of work seekers registered on ESSA per year. And you'll notice that because of the 5% improvement factor, that target annually is increasing as our efficiency processes also increase. On the registered work seekers provided with employment counseling, and the number of people placed, the number of people referred, and those referred, that is those referrals in terms of registered opportunities as well. What we have done in the APP is that we have, as part of ensuring that we are smart, the performance indicators are broken into four categories, ranging from the percentage of work seekers registered provided with employment counseling. Secondly, the number of work seekers placed in registered opportunities, and the number of work seekers referred to registered opportunities. And lastly, the number of work seekers referred to other services. And again, we give a breakdown in terms of UIF compensation fund and so on. Under labor policy and industrial relations, the strategic objective one, employment equity in the labor market, in short. Again, there are number of performance indicators ranging from employment equity regulations amended, because with the amendment of to the Act, we will then have to amend regulations, the annual employment equity report published, and the number of income differentials assessed to determine race and gender disparities in salaries per year. Under basic conditions of employment in the labor market, in short, there are two performance indicators there, one dealing with BCA regulations finalized, and the second one dealing with one child labor program of action implemented. On sectoral determination published for residual and emerging vulnerable workers, there are two performance indicators. On one dealing with the number of existing sectoral determinations reviewed and published, and the number of new areas for setting sectoral determinations investigated, and obviously hearings will follow. civil society organizations that protect vulnerable workers funded. The performance indicator there talks to the number of civil society organizations involved in the world of work funded and monitored per year. And this brings to an end the STRAT plan and the annual performance plan. And like I said, the targets are contained in the APP. And DG will then talk to the last component. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. The last slide basically is about just 4 points that we want to raise, one of which is a known fact that the budget vote is up and coming on the 22nd, the National Assembly, 23rd, at the NCOP. So we're just asking members to support our budget vote. And that secondly, of course, in terms of, you know, your work insofar as oversight function is concerned, would still continue to say that the portfolio committee continues to basically play that oversight function over the, our work. And that insofar as the proposed amendments before the Parliament, which are about to be tabled and or debated in the House, that would also converse for your support in that regard. And that in the performance of your oversight work, we will always be guided by your guidance and counsel from time to time. So thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, DG. When we opened earlier, I said to lead introduce us to your new members. I can see you've been poaching from us. There's a flow crossing from Parliament to the department. I don't know whether we have a deputy CFO or what's happening. Welcome, Dira Zahai.
From the Free State.
Honourable members, minus one. This is the presentation from the DG. Can we engage before we move into the? Or is the? I think we should break for dinner and then engage after this. Honourable Makubelo Mashele.
Can you
present your Hollywood?
Now, Chair, Mr. Sheffield is in the inspection and enforcement service. He has been there for a number of years now. The reason why he's here is precisely because the acting DDG IES couldn't be here precisely. He's attending to some other matter, some of which will require him between today and I think up until Wednesday. So he has been asked to come in to represent that particular branch. It would be remembered to recall that the DDG IES actually left us some 3-4 months ago, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere there. So we are in the process of actually filling that we are in the process of filling that particular position. I mean that's the best way I can put it, Chair. Of course, left in this particular case is that she passed on. Yes, in case. Nesi ntuke kuthiwa ke shile. So that's the one part. And the Mr. Marotoma stepped in after we released the then COO on the basis of Section 17, Subsection 3 of the Public Service Act, who absented herself from work for a duration of time. Now I'm just stating what the Act says, Chair. And then he's currently acting, and we advertised both IES and the COO DDG positions have been advertised. So we are in the process of filling those. So that's insofar as acting is concerned, thus far. So this is temporary acting in the form of Ms. Asiya Philip, because it's only here just for today and tomorrow. I'm sure next time Mr. Lamati would be here, and the other time a full-time sort of DDG will also be there after we complete the exercise. The same thing also with the COO. Thanks, Chair.
When we open meetings, we start with apologies. And if we're to receive this apology of the COO all the time, would they have advised or no? But why is this person always apologizing? So next time when we start meetings, if there's something that needs to be explained, let it be explained before we ask.
Okay.
You know, that we have somebody who is not here, and so will be acting on their behalf.
Okay.
I think it's much nicer doing it that way. Is there another thing that members would like to raise before we break for Jaja? Okay, let's take how many minutes? Let's take a 15 minutes break. And then we can grab something to eat and still reconvene. Those who haven't finished eating, we can eat and talk at the same time. Eat, think, and talk at the same time. It's not difficult. It has never killed anyone. Thank you.
Because with me, that is not a challenge, especially trying to design the IT issue. It's an opportunity for us to transform the department. And I think we need to portray it in that light, staying with time after the IT. And potentially what we're expecting the two things
to achieve.
It's an opportunity more than that. The challenge could be, I don't know, support.
I don't see how that works.
The UI and these others, we join them tomorrow. Or are they not going to make their presentation now? Yeah. There are the presentation points of clarity, and members can engage on the presentation. What happened last? This is a post-mortem thing, isn't it? Yeah, post-mortem, but it says the funeral will happen on such and such a day. They will be awake. Okay, Baulwan. Over to you, members. I've made some points I can get.
Please This is a bit of misconduct cases. I just want to check the severity of these cases. In the Cloffer scarves or Guajonchiwa or sexual harassment cases. What kind of cases are these? And how many of those cases tough management? How many of the people are in management? Tough management, middle management? Or are we talking about cleaners? The lower classes of the ethical. And the levels of, I mean, the levels of responsibility of these people who are just. Are they on suspension with pay, or are they charged and still at work, or what's up? There is this, okay, yeah, that will be the first one for me. Honorable Makubele Mashayana, Honorable Makaru.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Was it Makube? Oh, you go.
Okay. Thanks, Chairperson. Mine will be focusing on issues of the inspectorate. You know, I see the department in itself has targets that are put in place for inspection and enforcement in the department. But what we see here, I would want to believe, is not what we hear or the feedback that we get from various institutions, or when we do our oversight, we'll be faced with situations where people will say they've never seen an inspector come to inspect their workplace. They have never even seen one in the last or in the previous 5 years. Well, we are not saying that each and every workplace or the staff complement that we have can go and inspect each and every workplace in a month or so on, but the work should at least cover areas that have not been covered. Also, there's a research here that talks about inspection in construction sites. There's some professor who has written a paper on, or who has done a research on issues of compliance and safety in construction sites per se. And it talks on the ineffectiveness of the Department of Labor's inspectors in conducting their duties. You know, I would want to believe that when somebody does the research, they don't just thumbsuck, they go out and draw out a sample and actually do their work based on the sample that they've drawn out, and from that they are able to make an analysis of the respond or the response that they have received. And this research talks about in fact the number of inspectors that would go out, that would do the OHS, they would perform OHS. The ineffectiveness also on conducting police inspections and so on and so forth. Well, I want, is it not possible for the department itself to actually study and see how effective is its own inspection and enforcement department? Because one would want to tend to agree with the feedback that we that is out there, because from our own oversight in the Western Cape, in Northwest, we visited workplaces where an inspector was never ever on the site. That's my submission or my input for now.
Process.
Thank you, Chair. Just one of these little comments before I ask the question. I was listening to the DG there telling us about the CEO who left us, and he was sort of struggling as to how he's going to tell us without telling us what happened. And he quoted he left us because of section this or the other thing. That's when people don't want you to understand what they're saying, they quote you a section. And then they know, of course, you don't know what section 89 is or 139. But yeah, on a more serious note, I mean, if the guy has been fired, let's say he's been fired. All right. Yes, I just want to add on to the chair's question about the misconduct. Just add on the fraud that is on the slide just before the misconduct one. What's the nature of the fraud? Because we want to understand what these people are doing so that we can have a sense of what the kinds of problems the department has to deal with. When you say fraud, it's fine, it's a nice word, but we don't know what exactly they're doing. It's like misconduct, you know, so that we can do that. The other one has to do with the inspectorate. It looks like the people in the Western Cape just don't do anything. They're crazy. I mean, if you look at this report, it means these guys are non-compliant through and through. But what strikes me as quite intriguing, if you look on slide 17, and then you look on slide 18. Slide 17, the first part, they set themselves a target. They set themselves a target for 210. You'll throw those things there. And then they achieve 1,000. And then, of course, the outcome is as horrible as the others, unless I'm misreading this thing. And I want you to look also at the one 225 right at the bottom, where they have 607, 237, 00. Just, it doesn't make sense to me. What are they doing? Are these people not complying? And if the inspectorate is doing their work, why are the people not complying?
It's very difficult when you're the general secretary of some transport company to fire people. You don't want people to know that you are also firing people. so you understand where it comes from.
It's going to the territory.
Look, in terms of, I think all your inspectors, in terms of targets, except when you dealt with the public, that's the only place where your actual was less than your target. But everywhere else, your actual is always more than your target, if you look at all of them. I'm more interested in how do you set those targets? What influences you to set those particular targets? Because from where I'm standing, it's like you set them low so that you can get double the targets. Maybe there is a criteria which you use to set the targets. I'm the one who don't understand, but it's a little bit problematic for me. The other slide where I wanted to ask a question is the employment equity targets. I think it's slide number 25 where you talk about decent employment through inclusive economic growth. I mean, everybody knows that the figures are not impressive as far as employment equity generally is concerned. I'll be more interested to find out, man, how many companies have been fined for not reaching the target, because my experience with capital is that they only do things if there are consequences. When you beg, you can beg forever. They have got their own decisions and they stick to it. So I'm interested in that. And the last part is will be. No. It's not. I've got other two ones. Your civil society, the strengthening of civil society. I think it's financing FEDUSA, NAPTU, South African Labour Bulletin. I don't know. Is this still the South African Labour Bulletin? Do they still produce? Oh, okay. It must be interesting to see, to look at what they produce now. In terms of financing or contributing funds to them, do you direct them to do certain things? Do you just give the money to FEDUSA and say you do what you like with it? Or do you say, look, as part of this particular program, we believe that you are not doing enough as far as sensitizing your members to understand what is the meaning of democracy. If you don't have a majority, you don't have a majority. You don't have to stab anybody or shoot anybody. You must learn in the democracy to accept. Once your numbers goes down in a workplace, you can't fight to be representative. Or you just give them the money, they will see what to do with it. I was going to be interested. I think the lawyers will warn me when I wanted to talk about this thing of collective bargaining, because they will say it's sub judice. I don't know whether it's sub judice. But No. Your rules of parliament says that we cannot discuss what is in court. So I'm not very clear about how far is it in court. But I'm really interested in this thing because it is projected by the Free Market Foundation. I won't talk about others, but the Free Market Foundation, they talk about this thing as if it's something completely undemocratic, and it arose after the 1994 labor relations, but it has been there before, and they never had a problem with it when it was there. So I'm really interested in. I haven't seen their papers, so I would not understand what is their real beef about this. Because my understanding is that the unions, which is a majority within a particular sector, when they negotiate a collective agreement, that collective agreement is extended, but those who cannot afford can still apply. I thought that was my understanding. They can still apply for so that they can be exempted from paying that. That was my understanding, but I would really want to understand what is the free market thing. When you talk about protecting vulnerable workers, people talk about farm workers and all that. My own experience, maybe it's where I move around. The restaurants where they employ foreigners.
The
restaurants. No. The taverns are some people from Limpopo who attend them. And some AMCU members. But what is happening is that my experience is that the most vulnerable workers are those workers who are regarded as not having any rights, especially the Zimbabweans. In most cases, they are the ones you find in restaurants, where they are treated as if they have no rights at all. And employers are not, I don't know how successful your inspectors are in dealing with that particular situation. But what has also come out through very clearly is Chinese employers. The manner in which they treat people working there, and the people who are illegal who are working for these Chinese, I'm not xenophobic against your comrades, you know, but these ex-communists from China, when they come here, they become the worst capitalist in collaboration with the SACP. But but the issue is that, I mean, we from our own visits, that they always, you find at all places that the inspector says that you never find the real owner when you go there to inspect. They always say the owner is not here. What is done as far as that is concerned by the Department of Labor?
Thank you, Honorable Khanari. The achievements, this thing is worrying. It's slide 14. Problematic sectors in the wholesale and retail sector. The Northern Cape did not have a target. So they don't save them, they don't set themselves a target. And then they inspect 153 and then 116 comply. And then they say they have 76% success. I really don't understand this. How did he escape you that this region, it did not have target for inspection in the wholesale, in the retail industry? How did this happen? And all the targets we set ourselves, they are very low. Very, very low. And then from there we celebrate because we have achieved more than the set target. What's happening, DG, with this thing? And it's not only in this retail, even in lots of others going up in terms of inspection, if we will be taking it.
And the other one is public employment services. Is the number of employees registered on the system? But this system registers even employers. How many employers are registered on the system? Because we're only talking about job seekers.
Honorable Makubele Mashen, second bite.
Oh, sir, it's Chairperson. Oh, I nearly gave you the title of Sir.
You can call me Mr. Nchabeleng, Comrade Sir.
Yeah, Comrade Sir.
All titles.
Comrade Sir, Chief. On the issue of the public employment service, there were problems or challenges with the system in capturing these job seekers and their skills and their needs in terms of training and so on and so forth, because the Siemens story was given challenges. So I want to find out whether has that improved. If so, is it because Siemens has now put new PCs throughout the department, and what's the story? Because the actual is the fact is that it took the whole day, or even some days they could not capture information on the public employment service system.
DG.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson, honorable members. I would like first and foremost to just respond to some other few general points that I think have arisen in the course of the members' interventions. And then, of course, ask the respective branch leaders to then hone into some other specific areas that also have been raised by members. Let me just say that with regards to what I referred to about the COO, in the Public Service Act, the Section 17, Subsection 3, which talks to the issue of not reporting for duty by any employee in excess of 30 days, for an example, and that would then be considered as termination of your service or and or contract with the employer. So basically, the long and short of it, that's what the issue was about at that level. Now, we are on record as having said that we have capacity constraints insofar as the inspectorate is concerned. And I think in some other quarters we have made these particular examples. I think last week we were making an example before another committee to say, look, if we take an area like Bambirisnat, which has about 600 to 700 farms just around Bambirisnat in the Northern Cape, our department has only 3 inspectors for those number of farms around there. Now, if you were to go out here, this place, the Durance, I think we have about 350 farms around the Durance, for an example. And the number of inspectors that we can afford in that around that area, it's about 3. So it tells you this question of capacity constraints. That's the one issue. But it also raises another issue. It raises a broader issue of how we can... I'm scared. It might come when I move. I know. But it raises another issue. If we were to frankly ask the question objectively, what is then the sufficient capacity and number of inspectors that we should be having? Now, logically, what it tells is that you're not going to be able to have something called a sufficient number of inspectors, for an example. But it requires that we need to have a multi-pronged kind of approach around the issue of ensuring compliance at a workplace level. One of them is that, of course, we do need to conduct inspections, but also the other is to ensure that we have effective workplace organizations. So workplace effective organization is that the same people that you call workers, for an example, must be activated to firstly knowing their rights, but also join unions and so on, so that they are able to deal with the issues of compliance at that particular level. And I think this is not something that we can shy away from either talking about or calling for. So in other words, that multi-pronged kind of approach should also assist. On the other hand, there will also be a need to engage with employers and educate them about the creation of a safe and a viable kind of workplace and so on and so forth, and how that is good for business and is good for the country and so forth. So you need those kinds of advocacy kind of approaches and sessions. That's the one around the spectrum. So therefore, it is true that you would get to some other places where they would tell you that they've never seen a labor inspector precisely because of these particular shortcomings on our side. I think the other question that was raised is the issue of, I'll try and combine it, union representation, collective bargaining. My take is simple, is that you have a changing face of industrial relations in one form or the other, where in some other quarters there is this reported sort of union rivalry of sorts, over bargaining rights and so on. But that also tends to escalate to the broader sort of assault and affront to the concept and issue of collective bargaining, for an example. And I think collective bargaining, broadly speaking, in the South African context, is under attack. whether you speak about this case that you're referring to, which I'm not going to necessarily confine myself to that, but, and I think if you were to take the overall landscape, you would then see that basically collective bargaining is under serious attack and so forth. Now, and I think the issue of the issue of collective bargaining in the manner in which it is structured makes firstly institutional sense, but also, you know, deals with the issue of stability at a workplace level and so on. I don't think it's possible that you'll have a situation where a formation that is in the majority enjoys the similar sort of rights with a minority, or even for that matter with a union that is representing one member. It's not possible. In fact, I think that will be an assault to the notion and principle as well as concept of democracy, because what happens at a workplace level should also not be isolated from what happens, broadly speaking, within the societal sort of context. So I think some of these issues will also be further explored and be dealt with as and when we are convening what we call a labor relations in labor, for instance, as the Department of Labor during the course of the year. And I think members of this portfolio committee will also be invited to such a session, because indeed there is a need to begin to engage about some of these particular dynamics. What are the actual dynamics at an industrial relations level, and so it goes. However, there are disturbing patterns, Chair, that have also been emerging. The typical example that you made, that in recruiting membership, for an example, I don't have to step people so that I gain members. It just doesn't make sense. But I think what is beginning to happen is that there are serious leadership issues as well as industrial relations management issues that are beginning to emerge. and I think it's going to be important that I think some of these issues begin to emerge as and when we have the labor relations in Davao, for an example. Why do we have these kinds of situations as we experience them? And I think related to that, just to make another example, you know, pre-1979, specifically and particularly black trade unions were not recognized and whatever it was and so on. And you essentially had at workplace level something called, I think they were called workers' committees and or liaison committees. We're beginning to see an emergence of workers' committees, for an example, in certain instances. Now, and that's going back to pre-1979, pre-Wuhan Commission, before the Wuhan Commission came into existence and so on, which dealt with the question of the recognition of trade unions at the time. So I'm just then saying that for me these are some of the worrying trends, and I think at the labor relations endeavor that we're talking that we'll be convening, we will need to begin to have an interrogation of some of these particular matters. But nevertheless, let me then ask the branch leaders to deal with some of the issues. I think there was the issue of the nature of the misconduct cases, levels, and whatever. I'm sure inspectorate will still need to come on board. The question of some of the issues around fraud and so on, issues of compliance and non-compliance. So in that sort of order, please. Thanks.
Thank you,
Chair. The question on the severity of misconduct cases and the level at which these happened, is top management involved, middle management, lower levels, and maybe stats around that. Unfortunately, Chair, I did not bring any statistics with me, and any specifics around which the number of cases at the various levels within the organization, whether it's the lower levels, middle, or within the top management structures. Safe to say that the nature of the misconduct cases would relate to cases such as corruption, nepotism, favoritism, impropriety, misappropriation of funds, sexual harassment, and so on. So, you know, I can't specifically say at which levels these have happened, but I'd like to say that these are not limited to people at the lower levels. These would cut across all levels within the organization up to top management. The question around the nature of fraud cases, the majority of these fraud cases, you will note, would happen generally at labor center levels, because this is where money changes hands. This is where money is paid out to individuals, either as by way of compensation for injuries at work, or it should be for unemployment insurance benefits. So the fraud cases would include, for example, individuals asking other people, employees of the Department of Labor, asking people outside the department, for example, to open bank accounts where they would transfer money bogusly into those accounts, or have ghost individuals claiming unemployment insurance or funds from the compensation fund. So that should be the nature of the issues. I hope my answer suffices, Chairperson. Thank you.
There were, I think, four questions that relate here. One of the issues is how many companies have been fined, and I'm sure my colleague will also deal with this issue. I think the major problem with the Employment Equity Act is the law itself. That's the first thing. That's why we made proposal to amend the law. For example, on the areas of income differentials and race and gender issues, the law requires the DG to give the company the recommendation on how to deal with the issue. And of all the companies that were given recommendation, only one company has refused to accept the recommendation. That was our famous case with the airline Comair. But what I'm trying to say is that the law is such that it's not easy to go to court in those areas. You give a recommendation, they've got to apply those recommendations. The same thing on procedural compliance. The law, if you don't report when the law says report, the law requires that you must give an undertaking that says you will report. The law says that if you don't meet that record, that undertaking, that you will report in the next reporting cycle, then we must give you a compliance order that will say, I will comply. And that, for us, those are the issues that are preventing any finding and any going to court because of the cumbersome of the legislation. And if you look on the amendments that we've made, it deals precisely with those areas of the law that are making it difficult for us to reach that stage. On the issue of civil society fund, I think we members must remember, if you take 2 years, 5 years back, the civil society fund was called the Tsela Fund. That's what this fund was all set up on. It was set up to fund trade union training. And the reason in 2004 this fund was set up was because the parties, the social partners and the minister then, that was Minister Mboweni, foresaw a situation where foreign funding for trade union in South Africa is going to dwindle. There will be no foreign funding. As you have seen, I think last month, the British are saying South Africa does not need to fund you anymore. And then funding to NGO has gone down in the country, in many NGOs. I'm talking now about funding from international organizations and countries. Now, to try and circumvent that, a decision was taken to set up a Ditsela Fund. Therefore, all the money that was voted in by Parliament went to that fund, it was Ditsela. Then 3-4 years ago, we took a decision that, look, it's not right to only fund Ditsela. There are other organizations that needed funding. This is where then we changed the name to Civil Society Fund. You correct, member, honourable member, that it's funding, mainly 80% of the money goes to Ditsela. It funds COSATU, FEDUSA, NATU, on top of Ditsela, it funds the May Day celebration. And then it funds other smaller NGO like advice offices across the country. But the bulk of the money, there's no doubt, it goes to those to Ditsela, it goes to Labour Bulletin, it goes to the Workers' College in KZN. The minister visited the Workers' College, I think, a month ago because about 50 short stewards were graduating through that funding that the department has given, and they were receiving diplomas for the work that they were doing over 3 years. The Free Market Foundation, honourable member, the gist of their case, although they are raising other issues, the gist is this. They are saying the law as it is outsources legislative making. It gives parties too much power because the law says, they are taking the position where the law says if parties to a bargaining council are representative, the minister must extend. If they ask for the minister to extend when they are representative, they are 50% plus one. The minister doesn't have the discretion, must extend it. And that's their main attack on the issue. And they are saying that the role of setting up secondary legislation like sector determination and other is for the minister. The minister cannot outsource that. That's their main attack on the extension of the Section 32 of the Labour Relations Act that deals with the extension of bargaining council. And that's what we're defending, and we're trying to show that this is not South Africa, this is the international experience, the issue of extension of, I mean, that's our argument that is making on the issue, but that's their main attack on the legislation. On the, the issue of vulnerable workers, my colleague will deal with it. You're correct, all workers in South Africa, irrespective of whether you are a migrant worker or not, you are protected in terms of the legislation by the Constitution and by the law. The problem with migrant workers, especially migrant workers who are here, who are not documented, they don't want to use the word legal or not legal, who are not documented, when inspectors go in these areas, it's them who run away, not the employer, because they don't want to be inspected, because they fear two things. They fear that if they are inspected, the chances of being deported and all those issues, those are the problem. If you go to a farm, when they hear that there's an inspector, all the workers who are vulnerable will go to the bushes to hide from the inspector. They are not hiding from the employer. They take low wages from the employer. They take the treatment from the employer. But when inspectors go, it becomes very difficult then to enforce legislation and give them their rights. But in terms of our legislation, it covers all of them.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. I'll deal with three questions. The first one relates to targets. Now, this is something that has been debated within the government clusters. It's not an easy thing because you can be objective, but you can also be subjective. But we come up with targets so that we can have something to work towards. Targets in the Department of Labor are normally negotiated with the National Treasury. But for us to agree on certain targets, we look at the baseline information, our performance in the previous years, and so on. And then internally we follow a process which basically says in this area the population is X, the amount of staff capacity comes to X, the budget that we are allocating therefore should be X, and therefore the applicable targets should be X, so that we can then meet the national target that we have all agreed to. There are a number of elements that contribute towards either meeting the targets or not, and some are just management issues, tools of trade, and so on. But we believe that the process that we follow to set up the targets, I mean, in some cases, depending on marketing and all that, you can overachieve, and in some instances in the previous years, depending on the financial situation in the country, you have seen that we have set targets that we dismally could not achieve them as such. So there is always that problem, depending on what we do. Now, there was a question on the number of employers registered. Within PERS, we don't register or have a database of the total number of companies in the country. However, that information is available. From SARS, we are able to access a register of all companies that are that are registered for tax purposes in the country. And in the CIA of the UIF, we are able to get access to information on the number of employers that are registered for UIF purposes. However, the slide that we showed does indicate the number of companies utilizing the ESSA system for recruitment purposes. Now, this is quite important because you may find, I mean, if you take an example of ESCOM with the Mirupi, Kusile, I mean, all these big projects, the How Train, you find that it's one employer, but the number of opportunities that they register and the recruitment levels in terms of the numbers that they seek from us, including other private employment agencies, corporate permits, etc., is huge. So we did provide a slide on the number of companies that are utilizing the system. And this is just an increase from what we had last year to an increase in the first three quarters of 2012-13. Challenges with regard to capturing people on the system. Now, we investigated this matter, and again, there are a range of issues. The CIO can talk to the Siemens issues and so on. But, I mean, you have problems that range from cable theft, the slowness of the system. There are areas where we needed to enhance the system. In some cases, there are modules that were still lacking that are still going to be introduced to improve some of the components to deal with volumes and so on, and others have to do with the network that we have, especially on the speed. There are issues around capacity. There are issues around signals, especially when we use mobile buses, because they don't use cable networks; they use satellites, etc. And of course, there are other issues that were related to IT that the CIO can talk to. But the situation has improved dramatically. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. Maybe just to answer a few of those questions that have been asked in the context of the inspection systems. But let me preface what I'm going to say with the following. The responsibility to comply with our legislation is fundamentally the responsibility of employers. And therefore, when our inspectors go out and inspect a company, the notion of voluntary compliance impacts on how we do how we achieve those targets that we have. So therefore, going forward, we have said if a company complies, it's not an inspection issue. It is when a company does not comply that you have to deal with the company. If also. So if a company complies, why do you still bother about that company if the company complies? You need to bother and deal with a company that does not comply. And going forward, that is the issue. How do we deal then as an inspector with a company that does not comply? And that is how we going forward in terms of the report, the research report that the honourable member talks to in terms of the construction industry and the blitz inspection. We've seen the report. And part of the issue that we wanted to raise was maybe let's not deal with the specificities of the report, but fundamentally the policy issue that emerges out of the report. One of the things that we're doing, and fundamentally this comes out of our own work, own experience in the field, is that we have signed, as I've indicated, an accord with the construction industry. It says that how will you facilitate, as an employer and as unions in the industry, how will you facilitate compliance within the industry? Fundamentally and primarily because the notion of voluntary compliance is the notion that underpins most of our legislation, the enforcement regimes in most of our legislation. So we're dealing with the notion of the effectiveness of our responses in the construction industry. The second thing that we're also doing, and you're asking a very critical question, how do you measure the effectiveness of the inspectorate that you have? But shouldn't the question then rather be how does the effectiveness of the inspectorate address the vulnerabilities of the workers that we have in the workplace? And so that the effectiveness translates to less or fewer levels or lower levels of vulnerability in the workplace. And I think it's important that we do measure and at some point do measure that, and I would agree with the member on that. What we've done in the department is that we've started and we will pilot a sort of a state of compliance report. How does compliance look in the country? Given the resources that you have, how effective is the department? So in relationship to the number of inspectors that we have, in relationship to the number of resources that we have, how does that translate to an effective inspectorate system? And we intend to publish this report on an annual basis. Let's say, how effective is the department given the resources allocated to the department and its inspectorate? One thing, and I think the Honourable Chair has asked a question about Western Cape has not set a wholesale and retail target, but they achieve. So the targets that we're talking here to are of strategic intent. What are the strategic areas where we have levels of non-compliance, and where are they located? So the fact that Western Cape may not have, per se, a target for wholesale and retail does not necessarily mean that the Western Cape will not do retail inspections. Yeah, because if a client comes in from the wholesale and retail sector, the inspector needs to deal with that complaint, whether it's a reactive or proactive inspection in terms of the approach. So target and Mr. Maratova started addressing the issue of targets, but you see there's also the reality that an inspector can only do X amount within a specific period. And let's take a reference period of a month as an example. Given the resources, given the time that the inspector has to deal with everything, his administrative work, is the number of inspections, the resources that the inspector needs to deal with, the target is set based on the number of resources available to that specific inspector. So the sort of average number of inspections that an inspector can do, given all of these factors that impact, is about 13 inspections per month. Really 13. If you look at it, it makes a lot of sense. There's 20 working days in a month.
They take away the leave days that the inspector is entitled to, take away the administrative responsibility that an inspector has, and whatever. You come up with a sort of a very sort of comprehensive number that says an inspector can do X amount of inspectors a month. And that also informs how targets are set within the Department of Labor. You raise an issue about the foreign nationals and how we deal with it. And the example of the Chinese was raised, Chinese businessman was raised. Now, some of our bloat inspections, you will have noticed in Gauteng, for example, we had a bloat inspection that deals fundamentally with foreign nationals. And you know what the answer is that you get? We have no English. Oh, we have very little English. Yeah? We have very little English. Now, so what we've done with that specific, and since there's no singular dialect, Chinese dialect, there's no Chinese language. There's no language called Chinese. So there's a host of different. So what we've done for example, in the Western Cape, take the Basic Conditions of Employment Act and take the synopsis thereof and translate that into Mandarin, sort of the largest dialect, Chinese dialect that you'd find. And we're in the process of circulating this so that when you say you have little English or no English, at least we have, for that piece of legislation, you don't need English to comply in this regard. So those are the kinds of things that we're doing in terms of the inspection. the problem that we have, and I'm trying to answer the last question that was said, because I think the issues of targets have been addressed fundamentally, is how many companies did we take to court on employment equity? Or have we fined in terms of employment equity? The difficulties in terms of the enforcement regime, as Mr. Mkalipe has pointed out, is that the law is so onerous in terms of proving that, as a simple example, and I'm taking the Comey case again, is that the inspector must be able to say what the economic conditions would be in the next coming reporting period of that company, as an example. Now, if Stiglitz and all of these guys could not predict what the economic environment would be, do you expect an inspector to be able to predict what the economic environment would look like? So those are the sort of the iniquities in the law that those are the iniquities in the law that seeks to be addressed in terms of the proposed amendments. Thank you, Chair.
That Honourable Masrumulis.
Yeah, Chair.
The Chinese, these guys are just tourists, you know. Because if you go to the same shop and buy something, and you ask them questions about the product they are selling, they will explain. Mm. I remember once bought an umbrella from a Chinese shop. Went out in the rain, the umbrella just broke down immediately. then you go back to the shop and say, but this umbrella broke down. And the Chinese says, my friend, umbrella for sun, umbrella not for rain. Honorable Mr. Woods.
Yeah, Chair, very, very, very good one. From where I'm coming from, Chair, vetting will be very important. vetting will be very important for me. I'm beginning to get concerned because I'm asking this question for the second time around. It seems we are a little bit
slower. I'm not very sure whether this for you is located someplace or you have internal mechanisms to deal with, depending on the levels. I'm beginning to get concerned because at political level, vetting will give you a sense about commitment and loyalty. It seems we're a bit slow in that department. How far are we and how do we deal with this? The levels internal or someplace somewhere where the confidence is. Thank you.
Respond to the issue around vetting as something which we ourselves are very concerned about. There have been a number of meetings, for example, with the NIA, to say that. Mm-hmm.
No
problem.
We are allowed to speak.
Oh.
About the NIA.
Yeah. There's only one NIA.
Thank you, Chairman. Because vetting is the purview of NIA, and we our concern has been that because of the delays in vetting individuals, especially at SMS level, it meant that we could not take people on board soon after employing them, before the vetting process. So we engaged also with DPSA on the matter to see if there's any way of circumventing this or of creating a vetting unit within the department itself. Now the challenge is that only the Minister of Intelligence can appoint vetting agents within a department. So we were left with saying, let us first do a pre-screening. And post the pre-screening will give us an indication of where the person is at, both in terms of qualifications, any criminal records, etc., etc. That we can do ourselves, and we have been doing ourselves, and that the vetting itself will then have to ask NIA to do and ask them to hurry the process up. I must say, though, that in the last financial year up to now, the process has not been as bad as it was before. So we are seeing some improvements, but, I mean, it can still be improved. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Baya. Are there further comments from the members or additions from your DG and your team?
No, I think we... We're okay for now, Chief. Thanks.
Yes, they say that, you know, the question of the internal verifications of certain things will make this process alone much easier. Where, for instance, you check with the referees, look at the qualifications and all this, so that when you do a brief to NIA, you know, they won't have to go and looking for universities because some of the things would have done themselves. Of course, they'll have to verify some of the information. But I think it would be a very helpful thing if you have your own little thing on the side of the department. And because if you check that some of the qualifications are fraudulent, then immediately you will withdraw that name. Because the person has shown that there's something wrong with one of their, you know, qualifications or referees, for instance. If somebody says, I worked at Lever Brothers and they say, we don't know this person. So why should you send this information to NIA? Because already the person has lied about something. So I'm just saying that it would be very much helpful. The way you are, it will be much much helpful the way you are doing it, and I think you are doing a good job. Thank you very much. If there's no any other thing, we are going to meet again here tomorrow. Is it the same venue? M314 in Mark's building tomorrow. This meeting is adjourned. Good night.
Good night.
I was just laughing that you always wanted to bid us good night and you haven't been having a chance to tell yourself.